I'm Peter Williams. I've been a journalist and made films and documentaries all my life. I went to school in Bristol at what was the Merchant Venture School, was Cotton Grammar School by the time I got there. The book that I've written is called Being There, and it's really a record of a number of incidents which hit the headlines around the world, and which I was, by accident or design, at the heart of the action. And at a distance of many years now, I'm able to add a little more to each of those incidents. The book has... Go on.
Yeah, I'd say I think this is something that people that aren't journalists themselves don't necessarily realise, is that a story can sort of stick with one for quite a long time. And one of the great things about having bylines everywhere, and of course we're seeing quite a lot less of this in much of the press now. I mean, things like The Economist, for example, don't have any identification of who has written the article. It's just written by The Economist. And so having a byline is a crucial part of a journalist's work, so that if whistleblowers or anyone else involved with the story, relatives, etc., have got things to add, that there's a name to go to add to a story, or else to correct a story. Anyway, your career, you say, started, or certainly your education was in Bristol, and your career started there as well, I imagine.
Yes, I left school at 15 because, I preceded being kicked out by the then headmaster, whose name was Splinter Woods, a nickname he got because he was able to splinter a cane on your backside. I decided that I didn't particularly want any further education, got a job as an office boy on the Bristol Evening Post.
So could you tell us a bit about that, Peter? What was your experience at school that made you feel, look, I've had enough of this?
Well, it wasn't quite that. I mean, in the dark ages when I left school in 1949, you had the ability to achieve a standard at what's now O level called matriculation. And if you matriculated on certain subjects, I think maths, English, language, Latin and stuff like that, if you got credits in those subjects, you didn't have to take a higher certificate in order to get university entrance. So my parents, I'm from Wales, and I would have been the first of the Williams Thomas families to have gone to university. They were very keen that I did that, but I didn't really want to do that. And so I applied to the Bristol Evening Post for a job. My father was a journalist and I wanted to be a journalist as well. I think actually it was the fact that journalists wore trilbies and were rather glamorous, I thought. You know as well as I do that that's not the whole story. But in any case, I got the job as an office boy and stayed on the Evening Post for 10 years in a number of guises, a reporter, a sports sub-editor. I was for a time boxing correspondent of the Bristol Evening Post, which is on my CV. And I was also shipping and military correspondent, spent a lot of time at Avonmouth, finding out that actually more of a ship is actually under the water than is on top of the water, and that if you wanted to interview anybody, which is what I had to do, you had to climb a very, very long rope ladder to get up on deck. As I'm not very good for heights, I was quite eager to unload that particular correspondentship, but there you go. I found Bristol. I'd been evacuated to Devon during the war from Wales, and I found Bristol a city which gave me almost everything. It gave me, it has a busy cultural life, Many of the happiest years of my life were spent in Bristol. And when I left the Evening Post, it was to join the programme, the then programme paper for the New Kids on the Block with TWW, which were the then independent company, ITV company. I thought that by joining the programme paper, and there was I had a named column, the Peter Williams column, which advertised what was going on ITV that particular week. I thought that would be a way into television, actually getting onto the screen. I was completely wrong. It was far more difficult, and in fact, in the end, having written to every television company in the country and having been told, yeah, that's an impressive CV, now go and get some experience, I was reduced to writing back and saying, how the hell can I get experience if you don't give me a job? And in the end, Southern Television in Southampton interviewed me. It was run by an ex-BBC chap called Barclay Smith, and he brought BBC standards with him to Southern. And he was looking for new talent, and he had a group of us down for 3 days, in which time we did everything. We interviewed in the studio, we wrote scripts, we interviewed and wrote pieces on politics and on whatever story there was in the headlines on that day. And there was one vacancy. And in fact, he gave me the job, and he also gave a job to a chap called Ian Ross, who became a renowned ITN reporter. And so that's how I got into television. I then went to Southern to open the Southeast studio in Dover on a 6-month contract, and I've stayed in Kent for the last 55 years. So, you know, there's life is full of accidents, and sometimes what you anticipate doesn't quite happen. And then I went on. I'll try and give you a very quick shorthand of the rest of my career. I then went to Thames Television to join This Week, which was the best job in television. I stayed there 14 years and made more editions of the current affairs programme, which was, like its name implies, a weekly programme. I stayed there 14 years. Then I was headhunted to go to the BBC, where I worked for Panorama and Horizon, and my own series called Open Secret. And then I came back to Kent and joined TVS as head of documentaries and latterly controller of factual programmes, which I became a producer.
Okay, Peter, can you take us through some of the more memorable of those films? I mean, this was almost like a golden age that you were working in This Week, with other programs like World in Action going on at the same time, this kind of terrific rivalry going on between the different channels, which we don't really see at all today in terms of popular factual programs. So what are some of the most memorable of those?
Well, you described it as a golden age, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the authorities had a very different view of television in those days. They wanted to cover they wanted to cover current affairs, and there were three major programmes. There was World in Action, as you say, there was Panorama on BBC, and there was ourselves. And every week we had these three chunks of exploration in depth of an issue of the day. And I think television's the poorer for not having those regular slots. It was the best job in television. We had a program to produce every week. We didn't have a limitless budget, but you could go into, we had a regular Friday meeting, and you would go in to that meeting with an idea, which may or may not be adopted for that week, or it may be adopted for showing in 2 or 3 weeks' time. And the ability to have a canvas like that to pursue what you think is important is very vital. Earlier on, I think you said the authored piece is fading away these days. I was never in favor of standing in front of the camera and talking and telling viewers what they should be thinking, because I always think that sort of reporter gets in the way. But I am in favor of coverage of current affairs events where the facts are accurate and they're simply laid out for the viewer to make up his or her mind as to what either they should do about it, what should be done about it, what the government might do about it. And also the question is, why aren't they doing something about it? And so I think it's there are programs, of course, which do that today. And I'm not saying that there isn't. But this was a regular thing. This was a framework on which British television was based. It had
Can I just try and pin you down on a couple of really memorable shows?
Yes, I mean you say, we broke. People ask me that, you know, what's the, because I made a lot of films, they ask me, what's your most memorable show? And I always say the next one, because that's true. If you lose your appetite for doing it, then give up.
Yeah.
You again said the personal factor is important. Once you get immersed in a subject, for a matter of some weeks, you become a world expert. And I don't say that grandly, but simply because that's the only thing that is in your mind at that moment, that you are actually concentrating on something which you think is important and you hope others will think important. Then you do, if you do your homework properly, you do become an expert because you have to be an expert, because you are talking to people about a subject about which they are experts. And they quickly find you out if you haven't done your homework. It's difficult for me to say, but we had the exclusive access to the birth of the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, who came from Bristol. The friendships that I made while following that story for 4 or 5 years with Patrick Steptoe and Robert Edwards and with the Brown family have lasted through the years. One of the things which the book says that Edwards and Steptoe, who created Louise Brown in a petri dish, were heavily criticized by their peers, and their grant for this work, which was so important to those childless couples who couldn't have a child of their own by natural circumstances, this work, which was funded by the Medical Research Council, the MRC, the criticism of them was so heavy that the MRC withdrew their grant. If they hadn't battled on, if they hadn't had a determination to carry on with what they believed in, Louise Brown would never have been born, and maybe RDF may not have happened.
Well, that's interesting you saying there something which is completely new to me. I mean, I always think of these as test tube babies. That's the phrase that was used. And you're saying actually it was a Petri dish.
It was a Petri dish, yes. The man's sperm and the woman's egg were combined in a petri dish, and the embryos created there were then the best ones were chosen and reimplanted in the mother. That's what happened. And it happened in a little hospital in Oldham in Lancashire, not in one of the major teaching hospitals, which was, of course, one of the things I think which the medical establishment didn't like. But, you know, we were in the hospital when it happened. And it's an enormous privilege to be trusted by the people who believe that this is something which they're contributing to life, to society, whatever, that you're trusted by them so that you're on the inside and the world's press is on the outside. And this happened to me a number of times, and really that's why I wrote the book. On the back of that, on the back of the birth of Louise Brown from Bristol, the American networks saw what we had done, and we also went to the United States and did a similar thing for the first U.S. baby, Elizabeth Jordan Carr, who was born in Norfolk, Virginia, and who incidentally went on to become a journalist, but that's another story.
Your book, particularly, I mean, you go through quite a lot of these stories. I'm not sure how much of them, how many of them were to do with this week specifically. And also you include something on the pandemic. So this is obviously bringing things up to date a bit as well. What about you? You talk about meeting James Jesus Angleton, the famous American spy.
Extraordinary man. An extraordinary man. And I believe that it was the last interview, major interview that he gave. He was a friend of Burgess and McLean. And he was just an extraordinary man. It was rather like talking to a man who had a labyrinth for a brain. You got what he wanted to tell you. And he led you through the maze in exactly the way that he wanted to do that. But I had met him before, and I have no idea I have no idea why he decided to do this with me. I had no idea at all. I didn't know him terribly well. I think he was just unloading. And sometimes, as a journalist, you know that if you're in the right place at the right time, and people want to set the record straight as they see it, that's suddenly when you get a story.
So what did he tell you?
Oh, we went through the whole gamut he hated John F. Kennedy. He didn't trust him. His favorite was Ronald Reagan. He resented interference from other statutory bodies like the FBI in the United States. But he was a sad man. I mean, because he felt betrayed by one of his greatest friends, Philby. He was very close to Philby, who, as you will remember, was defected to Moscow. At the pinnacle of his career, was completely conned by Philby. In fact, one of the last people that Philby went to before he went off to the Middle East and then on to Moscow was Angleton. They had tea together, and I know Angleton was personally hurt by what he felt was a betrayal by somebody he had seen as a friend and also on his side, if you like, of the fence, when in fact he was talking to a Russian spy.
Well, I mean, this does show a kind of almost farcical nature of these intelligence services like the CIA. Angleton, I think I'm right in saying, was the head of counterintelligence, and he'd been basically chit-chatting with Philby. So he'd been spilling the beans on every secret that the West had, America had, straight to Moscow. Well, wonder what the point of these intelligence agencies is if the man at the top is telling Moscow everything.
Yeah, I mean, I pass on that because I have no idea. All I do know is that whatever he did, he would have been controlled in what he said. But in a similar way, of course, Philby would have been controlled in what he said. And it must have been, every meeting must have been like a game of chess. I mean, this is a man who had huge power. This is a man who was able to, whether legally or illegally, open every letter he wanted to open that went through the US mail. And he had a special department set up to do that. And that included snooping on congressmen and senators and a variety of other people. It was an extraordinary power that he had.
You also look into the history of Britain's nuclear power industry. I mean, I think this is a fascinating story because it was obviously begun at the end of the Second World War with the wish to make nuclear weapons. Then it turned into a way to generate power. So how do you see that developing and what do you think today? Because it's being sold to us now. You know, this is the way apparently that the future of energy is going in Britain, although I'm not so sure personally living near Hinckley as to whether that's going to be a roaring success because of the price of the energy, etc. But it's being given as a sort of magic bullet now to, you know, no more oil, gas, coal to generate power. Nuclear is the future.
I think you're right. And the chapter, I've written what I hope is a considered chapter on it. A chap who was in many ways at that time, the period you're talking about, the supremo, was a chap called Walter Marshall. And Walter Marshall was, without any doubt at all, a nuclear, of the nuclear lobby. But if you look at if you read the chapter in my book, you'll see that even Walter Marshall foresaw that unless the rules were kept, there would be disasters. And there were disasters which were tried to be covered up. There were losses of top-grade uranium. There was the explosion and flooding in Japan. I have a high regard for Marshall because he was trying, although he was a champion of nuclear power, he was trying to spell out that there are risks that go with it. We don't hear much about the risks these days, and it may well be, because I'm not an expert, that the risks are far less than they were 50 years ago. I don't know that. What I do know is that he anticipated and was in Tokyo actually acting as an advisor about in the 2 years before the major nuclear explosion and flooding in Japan. So, yes, I think, you know, in our striving for good, there is often a dark side to it, isn't there? I mean, people have got choices. What they do with what's possible is down to human choice. And you could say that the splitting of the atom has brought enormous good in the fact that it's revealed that there is so much energy contained in a tiny, tiny particle. And used to the good, it's fine. There will be those who argue militarily the fact that it is such an end-all deterrent that's helped world peace. There will be others who argue, well, yes, but the risk is always there. And the rogue, you know, they say in America, don't they say, well, you know, the best defense against a bad man with a gun is a good man with a gun. But that doesn't always work. And we've seen that tragically and most recently in the school shooting.
Well, I mean, you could argue that in a way around the world, the West kind of lost its mojo in Iraq because of the illegal war there. I mean, the desperate situation that it's thrown Iraq and the surrounding countries into in 2003. I mean, Afghanistan, I think, is just seen as a little bit further away, but Iraq is much closer to the center of the Middle East and the center of the world, really. And I know you also have done quite a lot of digging around the dodgy dossier and the death of David Kelly, the government scientist who looked like was trying to tell the British public through the BBC that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and then bizarrely committed suicide.
Well, if he did commit suicide, there is. I'm not an expert on this. But what I do know is that that we went to war in Iraq based on a lie, and this is obviously a very political area in which to express your views, but. I, from the work that I've done, I'm convinced that much of what Andrew Gilligan said on the BBC and before the dodgy dossier was produced, much of what he said following his interview with David Kelly was basically true. You will remember that not only was this something which you will remember well that the 45-minute claim, which our Prime Minister, our then Prime Minister Tony Blair said, was never substantiated. In my view, that claim that weapons of mass destruction could be rained down on Britain within 45 minutes, that was one of the prime reasons that influenced public opinion to go to war. As we all know, no evidence has ever been produced to indicate that that was true. The subplot of that, of course, is that it brought government into head-on conflict with the BBC. Greg Dyke, who was then Director General, his instinct, and I know him well, his instinct is to support his troops. And his instinct was to defend Gilligan from the outset. He did his own work, and I believe he was satisfied in his own mind that Gilligan was substantially correct. That didn't save him from his job. It didn't save him from fierce criticism, both from Alistair Campbell and from Tony Blair. And he and the chairman, Gavin Davis, both left the BBC. I think that is a wrong that has never been righted. As far as I know, no apology has ever been issued to Greg or to Gavin. And I think that's part of the Kelly story. I think it was also deeply unhealthy that the BBC were seen to bow the knee to government pressure. I think the BBC governors at that time have a lot to answer for.
Well, I think a lot of people in the Middle East would agree with you, Peter. And one of the things that you've looked at, which isn't part of your TV documentary work, is the pandemic, or plandemic, as some people call it, something that some people say has been in preparation for a long time, and that wasn't exactly as it was spun. So, as a veteran of many years working in broadcasting, what did you make of what happened in 2020 and 2021? We're pretty much out of it now in 2022, although some would say we better prepare for another lockdown any time.
I think you're absolutely right there. You know, okay, we're not out of it. We have to learn to live with it. And those of us who are more than 21, like me, have to be very careful indeed, because, you know, it affects elderly people rather more than most. However, I have a personal interest in this because my father, who served in World War One on the Q ships, which in the Navy, contracted Spanish flu and lost a lung because it developed into tuberculosis. And he carried that with him throughout his life. And he died. He carried on very bravely, in my view, a career again in Bristol, among other places, as features editor and editor of various other newspapers, even though he had only one lung. So the people probably know more now than they did 20 years ago about the number of folk who died at the end of World War One in 1918 from Spanish flu, which broke out, as I say, as the First World War was ending. More people died from Spanish flu than in the whole of the Great War, World War One. And it was really the first pandemic after the Black Death, the plagues of the Middle Ages, that was literally worldwide. My criticism of politics in this country is that we are always thinking short term. That's probably not quite fair, but we concentrate on the short term rather than the long term. And Spanish flu and the pandemic that we've just gone through with COVID is a classic case in point. What not many people know is that in 2016, 4 years before the COVID epidemic broke out, we had a full-scale national pandemic exercise. Sure, it looked at flu and how we would cope with flu. And it was a full-scale exercise which embraced the population, the health service, prisons, police, the media. The media, to the degree that the attempt to make the exercise so realistic was taken to the degree of preparing news bulletins which were played out during the course of this exercise, which lasted 3 days all over the country, so that the reality of what was going on, bodies in the streets, thousands dying, was brought home to those folk in the National Health Service and outside it who were actually taking part in the exercise. At the end of it, after the end of 3 days, the official sat back and said, "Now, how did we get on?" And the reality is that we failed in every single aspect. We were judged in 2016 to be a nation incapable of reacting positively and effectively to an epidemic. Now, this report, and I know because I know somebody who helped to write it. This report was presented to government, but I don't think it's ever, even to this day, been produced. Various leaks have taken place in busy newspapers such as The Guardian and The Telegraph. But in its entirety, I think it's still, as it were, under wraps. And I think it's almost criminal, because at the beginning of the pandemic, you will remember that a lot of our stuff, a lot of our protective clothing and that sort of stuff was out of date. And without going into great detail, there were lessons to have been learned, which 4 years before the outbreak of COVID could have led to improvements that would have cured everything, but would have alleviated the worst effects of the pandemic when it arrived. I also privately think, which is no longer private because I'm going to tell you, I also privately think that somebody in authority in government at that time must have known about this report and the fact that we had failed as a nation to cope properly with it. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Boris Johnson decided to go for herd immunity, because anything else would have been ineffective. That's a theory. I have no idea. But if I were a politician, I would be very tempted to look at it that way. If I implemented any measures rather than wait, there are those who say that the delay of the first 2 weeks or so was crucial in over the number of deaths. I would have been quite tempted if I knew that that my infrastructure was going to be incapable of coping with the pandemic as it arrived. Discuss.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what my answer to that is. He who hesitates is lost, because that decision needs to be right from the start, I think, and it needs to take into account the severity and the parts of the population targeted by a particular disease, and you've got to get those things right pretty quickly. But I'm interested. I mean, you and I both know sometimes we come across the wrong story. That sounds to me like that exact thing, Peter. You know, so somebody has got an information that we cannot cope with the pandemic. That's the last thing we want to hear when we're in the middle of one.
That's true. But you will know, going back to Kelly again, that for some reason or other, and your guess is as good as mine, any documentation with regard to why there was no inquest on David Kelly has been an embargo for 70 years. It'll be 70 years after his death that we will be able to find out why no inquest was ever held on David Kelly.
And we've got a similar thing with the Pfizer documents to do with their initial trials on these jabs that they were, you know, the vaccines that they were preparing. Anyway, you start your book looking at the Titanic, and I love this because what you've done, I think, is show that in a way it relates to what we were talking about in the nuclear industry, that there are severe, of course, at the time, around the time just before the First World War, when the Titanic hit an iceberg and sank, or whatever happened to that ship, they were talking about the unsinkable ship. You know, it was almost like they were tempting fate. And yet there were some people who were saying, look, you shouldn't let this ship sail. That, I think, is similar to the nuclear story, in that if you're going to have some big operation like the Titanic or like a nuclear power station, if you don't take the proper safety precautions, something is bound to go wrong. So can you just briefly, take us through what you know about what happened with the Titanic?
Well, the thing about the Titanic, and it was a world-shattering experience, is that no laws were broken. The number of lifeboats on the Titanic were within the Board of Trade regulations for the number of lifeboats on the ship. The scandal was that there were those, even in the design team of the Titanic, who said to the owners, White Star Line, we should have more lifeboats because whether or not you think it's unsinkable, we have to have lifeboats enough to carry passengers and crew. It's a lot of people away in safety if the unthinkable happens. And those people who argued that left the company. In fact, one of them left the company and set up with the guy in Denmark who designed new davits. Every lifeboat sits under a davit, which is like a little crane. This guy called Wellin designed a davit especially for the Titanic so that three or four lifeboats could be grouped under each davit. And therefore, although they took up space on deck, The fact is that there were four boats. There could have been four boats under those davits rather than one or two. There were two inquiries, one in America, one in the UK. And at no time were the representatives of the White Star Line questioned hard about why, following these warnings and these conversations with the guys who were championing the need for more lifeboats, why they didn't listen to their opinions. And that, in a way, was the root of the legend, well, we don't need the lifeboats because it's unsinkable. The White Star Line did nothing to advertise this as the unsinkable ship. On the other hand, White Star Line did nothing to disabuse anybody if they felt that this ship was unsinkable. And as you all know, it wasn't. It was sinkable and it wasn't impregnable. And 1,200 people died. So that's a lot of people. And I think, again, there is a process which occasionally fails. There's a parallel, if you like, between what happened in the Titanic inquiry and what happened in the David Kelly inquiry. The right questions were not asked. And if they were asked, certainly in the case of Titanic, the White Star Line representatives lied. They lied because they said there had been no conversations involving the need for more lifeboats. They lied and they were never caught out until you read my book.
If we were sitting in the production office at this week, Peter, we'd be probably talking about some of the stories today going round. One of the things that's come up this week is over in the Republic of Ireland, the Allied Irish Bank is deciding to go cashless. Many of its branches will no longer be allowing anyone to use cash. Now, this seems to me like the media's job to look at all this, because that none of this is really being had any proper public debate about it. None of this is going through the Irish Parliament or the British Parliament. But and yet we are moving towards this cashless society at a rate of knots. It's basically being decided by the banks. What do you make of this move?
I'm not an expert, certainly not a financial expert, although, yes, I've managed to run businesses. But I think I'm going to be partisan here. I'm 89. I'm fairly conversant with new media and that sort of thing. But I live near a town called Faversham. The last bank in the town is about to close, and we are told, oh, well, you can do it online. There are a generation, which will soon be gone, of people who find it very difficult, and some, through disability or whatever, almost impossible to conduct their lives online. And I think there is, although I have to say, in the COVID instance, the vulnerable have been well looked after. But there is a tendency to say, to look to the future and ignore the present. There are hundreds of thousands of people who will not even begin to understand what a cashless society is. And that's a fact. I also happen to think that Northern Ireland is an odd place in which to start it when there isn't a parliament in being. I mean, they can't even agree to sit in the same place.
Actually, no, this is in the Eurozone. It's in the Irish Republic that they're
now. It's in the Irish Republic.
Yeah. My worry, and if I was sitting with you in that production office chatting, is, well, hang on a minute. A lot of this electronic stuff is, it kind of doesn't work sometimes. I mean, for example, I put my card in the machine the other day, and it just spat it out. It says, no, can't read your chip. You know, so you're at least you're in the situation. Imagine if you're just, you know, you're in a situation where, I don't know, you've got to fill up with fuel. You're on the motorway. You've got a few you know, a kind of little bit left in the bottom of the tank, but you need this electronic stuff to work. And of course, we all know sometimes the computer says no.
You're absolutely right. And the same thing has happened to me. And you say, if I was sitting in the This Week Friday meeting and this week, I would say this is something we should be looking at. And we should be arguing, if you like, from the minority point of view, or at least highlighting the difficulties of the minority. And very easy to ignore a minority. Very easy.
Okay, so your book is Being There, a Titanic, Marlon Brando, and the Luger Pistol, of which you will find out much more if you get hold of a copy of the book, by Peter Williams, and a foreword by Sir Jeremy Isaacs and Sir Clive Jones. Do you want to just tell us a bit about the people who've put it forward? Written a foreword for you, Peter.
Well, one of the chapters in the book is called Missions, and Jeremy Isaacs was my boss for many years at Thames Television, and he would use me, and he would probably not use this phrase, but as a troubleshooter, so that if there was a difficulty, I was sent to try and sort it out, and we produced some pretty good programs from that. For instance, on one occasion, he said we had done and the inside story of Ruth Ellis, the last woman to hang. And I was convinced that she had an accomplice who never stood in the dock beside her. And we had made the film, and Jeremy had seen the film. And he said, well, the only way we're ever going to get this past the lawyers and on the screen is to find the accomplice. Well, that's a bit of a showstopper, because we had no idea where Desmond Cusson was. We then pursued for the next research for the next couple of weeks and found that Desmond Cusson, Ruth Ellis's accomplice, was, they said, living in Australia. Well, we didn't know where he was in Australia. So you won't believe this. We looked in the phone book, and in Perth, there was Desmond Cusson listed florist. I had no idea whether this was the same Desmond Cusson, but in fact, I had a friend in Australia who went and looked. He said, yeah, I think it is the same. This photograph looks the same. So on those, with that, we all got onto an aeroplane and flew to Perth. And on whatever it was, a Tuesday morning, as he came to open his shop with his florist and his carnations and his antirrhinums and whatever, I was there on the doorstep and said, Mr. Cusson, do you remember the day that you taught Ruth Ellis how to shoot a gun? And from that, we got the only interview ever recorded with Desmond Cusson, which I then added as a postscript to a book which I'd written about it at that time. So that was rather a long-winded answer to what Jeremy is to me. Jeremy was one of the giants of television, in that he set up Channel 4, and and when he handed it over to Michael Grade, he said, if you don't handle this baby properly, I shall come back and haunt you. And I think that says everything you need to know about Jeremy. Clive is Welsh and a friend. He was a controller at the same time as I was with TVS, a man of immense talent, huge contributions to ITV's news coverage, now knighted, as they both are. And I need to say no more about Clive, in that he's just a friend and a real pro.
Yeah, well, it would be nice to have some more Lou Grades and Jeremy Isaacs around in modern television. I think it would make an enormous difference. And I'm sure Jeremy would be very upset if he thought that Channel 4 was being privatised, Peter.
I don't know. I imagine you're right.
Anyway, Peter Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Great. And good luck, Tony, and I hope it goes well.
And do you want to just tell us how people can get hold of the book? You've got a website, or is just on the usual?
Yes, my email address is peter@pwtv.co.uk. Just send me, and for the princely sum of 15 quid, you can have it.
Peter Williams, thanks very much for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you.